Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in this first hour of the show, we will have another conversation about poetry. We've been fortunate to, over the last few months, have some poets here on the program, a number of them here on the campus as part of the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series. This is an event that's sponsored by the Department of English, their MFA Creative Writing Program. And throughout the school year, they bring writers, people who write prose, people who write poetry, some people who do both, so they can read their work, and also so students here at the university can have time with them and talk with them about their own work. And our guest here this morning on the program actually is someone who at the moment is here based at the University of Illinois, Susan Summers Willett. She is here teaching at the University of Illinois. She's an Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral in the humanities and teaches courses in creative writing and contemporary poetry and poetics. She also has published a collection of her work entitled Rome that just came out, and as well as her poems have appeared in many different journals. She's won some awards for her work, and we're pleased to have her here this morning with us to read and to talk a little bit about writing. She will be giving a reading, by the way, and that will be part of this, again, part of this series. They all take place, I think they all take place on Tuesdays.
It varies from Monday to Tuesday, yeah. I think.
In any case, her reading will be tomorrow, Tuesday, at 5 o'clock.
4:30.
And this is at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus in the Authors Corner. And if anybody was interested in stopping by and hearing her and maybe meeting her, well, you can certainly do that. And here on the program as well, as we talk, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
I read something about you that I thought was kind of interesting, and that has to do with your enjoyment of, love of, interest in performing poems. Mm-hmm. Now, and then that raises in my mind this question, well, when you use that word performance and when you think about that in terms of presenting your poems, in what way is that different from just giving a reading or anything else that a poet do? I would think, well, any time the writer stands up in front of a group mm-hmm. of people and reads the work, that's, in a sense, that's a performance. But do you mean something different, or do you think something different when you use that term?
Well, this is a fantastic question, because this is I teach a poetry and performance class at the U of I, or I did last year, and I had my students write their very first paper on this very issue of how do we distinguish a reading and a performance. I think for me, the difference between a reading and a performance has to do with how well you come to embody the voice of the poem. For me, that's when you cross the line into performance. So there are some of my poems, I think, work well just reading from the page, and they exist in that medium. But others, I think, really call to be embodied in terms of voice and, you know, getting away from the page. And I try to use both print media and performance media. Now, other people will give you different responses as to what makes a reading or a performance. But for me, the embodiment of the voice is what marks that line.
Hmm. Tell me some more about what exactly you mean by that embodiment of the voice.
Well, it has to do with it's a little theatrical. You take on the voice within your, not only, you know, with the with vocal expression, but you take it on physically as well. So that's, I think, where the performative element comes in, that, you know, you wear the voice, you embody it, you put it in your own skin. And that, you know, is really an exciting place to be in.
Yeah. And this is very interesting, because just last week, Chris Abani was mm-hmm. here on the program. He is a Nigerian born writer. He mm-hmm. now teaches in the United States and is both a novelist and a poet. And we really, I don't know that we talked very much about poetry in the conversation. We talked some, but interestingly enough, someone called in and said, you know, you poets, you have this way of reading your work that puts people to sleep. At least that was the comment of the caller. And you know the kind of thing that I'm talking about. He said, yes, I sort of know what you mean. And that's what we sometimes call the poet's voice or something like that.
Right.
He seemed somewhat sympathetic to what it was the caller was saying. So it seems to me now, if the kind of thing you're talking about is something other than that. This is, I would imagine, and you can give us an example, that you're not going to be putting anybody to sleep with the kind of performance that you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, this ties in a little bit with my scholarship in slam poetry. Slam poetry is something. Are you familiar with what a poetry slam is?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
It's for those listeners who may not know, it's poetry slams are competitive poetry readings or poetry performances, I should say, mm-hmm. Where people get up on stage and perform their poems within a 3-minute time limit. And randomly selected members of the audience actually judge the performance Olympic style from 0 to 10. And this is actually what I've been working on the last couple of years here at the U of I is working on criticism about performances of identity in this competitive format. And I think one of the characteristics of slam poetry, if we can pin down some general characteristics, one of them is that it tries to aggressively entertain its audience. And I think it's really revolutionized what's happening in contemporary poetry, because poets are suddenly asking, what responsibility do I have to the audience? The definition of entertainment can be confrontational, it can be comedic, it can be sensual. Entertainment is a very general term, but I think that poets are, as a result of Poetry Slam and a few other things, starting to realize that they need to better engage their audiences if the art is going to survive.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because it also runs counter to the idea that I'm sure a lot of people have about poems and poets, that it's a sedate sort of quiet exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of it being such a sort of aggressive performance art, I think a lot of people would say, well, that's not what I think of when I think of poets and poetry.
Right, right. Well, what's interesting about Poetry Slam is it takes poetry into the public sphere. It takes it out of that private interior space that we often think of with poetry and you know, the one-on-one relationship that we have when we read a book, that very private interior act. And instead, Poetry Slam takes it into the public sphere. Poets and audiences are working together in a public community. They're voicing their opinions publicly about what they think good poetry is and bad poetry is, and the spaces in between. Mm-hmm. So it's really revitalized, I think, the public conversation about poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, now here we're about 10 minutes in, and I think I'd like to give you the opportunity to read something so that people listening can also hear you read
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll start with the first poem in my book, Rome, which is entitled Self-Portrait as Interstate 10. And it's about the time that I've spent living along and traveling on I-10, which is, of course, the southernmost interstate going from coast to coast. There are two types of cacti that I mention in here if you're not familiar with it. Saueros, which is what you usually think of with when you think of cacti, the sort of Marge Simpson with her hands upraised. And also the ocotillo is another cactus mentioned here. Self-portrait as Interstate 10. Still, the sky is the great equalizer. Still, I yawn into the visible, yellow sun, shack, mountains of uncertain range. What gives life are two directions, to and away like a decisive heart. The saueros wave in the way of surrendering bankers. What is it to be a sign, a coffee cup, the grave of a doll's discarded leg? I end. I begin. I have known death and have doubled back. I am the last gas station on its three stilts rising out of the sea, or the child born there. To hear the ocotillo burst into white laughter after rain. To be the keeper of distances, defined by landscape and trash. To the foal of cows in spring, and the crossing corpses of Texas, I say, come unto me. Leave. Here, a cross marks the earth where three sisters have buried their animal. Here, the dung of a beast grows sweet to dry in the sun. To know not night, but the fading of a lamp. To live the constant gray of a bayou. And here, in L.A., here, in Florida, here, in Lake Charles, towers of sulfur flicker and that hell singes its lit eyes against the good white clouds. Here, swamp, bay, monument, tin can with a mouth ragged as a southern woman, and I am her spine pressed to the bedsheet. There is no home, only postcards. No relationship unmarked by distance. Of all things, I am the same photograph taken at different times of day. Me, the lyric of truck tires in a deluge, or me, those years of dark water in a plant's heart, or me, that small animal blooming in a hawk's fist, not drowning, not waving, but falling out of the sky.
Very nice. Can you talk about that poem a little bit? Is there anything in particular that you say that would illuminate it?
Yeah, well, I'll say that the book Rome, which is it's the verb to roam, R-O-A-M, not
the place
Rome,
in
the city,
Italy.
Although there is a poem in the collection called Where He Lives Rhymes with Rome, which is R-O-M-E, so it's a little confusing. But it's the book is sort of loosely organized around the event of my father's death of cancer about 13 years ago, and the sort of sense of the loss of home that I had after that and sort of coming to terms with that. So a lot of the book has to – there are many images of flying and wandering, roaming throughout the book, and so that opening poem is really about that search, that initial search of my father has died. At the time my mother moved from New Orleans, my hometown, to Arkansas. We put all his things out on the curb for Goodwill to pick up, and so there was and I had lost my childhood home, my house. So there were it was a general sense of displacement that I was dealing with at that time, and that's when most of these poems were written. Those were the issues that I was dealing with.
How old were you when that was going on?
I was 19 when my father died. So, now you can tell how old I am.
Well, I guess I hadn't really thought about it so much until just now, but that a lot of these poems do seem to reflect this sense of being a little lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are also I speak in some of these poems. I speak in the first person directly about the experience of losing my father. There are some other poems that are written in the voices of mythological characters, historical characters, literary characters. Ophelia is one of them, and several of those. I realized after that I had written them that I was using those characters to speak about aspects of my experience that I wasn't ready to talk about yet, or to give voice to members of my family who I didn't feel comfortable representing necessarily in the first person. So there's that strain running through it too. But there's a poem written in the voice of Daedalus about the loss of his son Icarus falling from the sky, which I realized after the fact again that I was using that poem to represent my grandfather's experience of losing his son.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Susan Summers Willett. She is teaching here at the University of Illinois right at the moment. She's an Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral fellow in the humanities. She's the author of a collection of poetry entitled Rome, that's R-O-A-M, not the place in Italy. It's published by the Southern Illinois University Press. She is going to be giving a reading of her work tomorrow at 4:30 in the afternoon. This is at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus in the Author's Corner, so anyone who is interested in attending can do that. This is part of the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series, an event in the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program. She teaches courses here in creative writing and contemporary poetry, and questions, of course, are welcome, too, if you'd like to call in. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You said, I think actually it was before we actually started, that you think of yourself as a Southern writer. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a question that we're dealing with in the course that I'm teaching right now, Contemporary Poetry and Poetics. It's hard to say, to put a definition, I think, on what Southern writing is. I know that I classify myself as a Southern writer because some of my poems take place in the South. Obviously, Self-Portrait is Interstate 10 is, I consider that a Southern poem because it deals with that section of geography. But I think also it has to do with representing a certain sensibility and a certain attention to the musicality of language. There's a poem in this book called Notes for Living in NOLA, which is New Orleans, Louisiana, that uses sort of a blues cadence. And that's certainly something that I'm taking from that sense of language, that rich sense of language. I'm bringing and applying directly into the work. So I think that it has to do with not only how you represent what the geographical representation, but I think it also has to do with how you use language.
Yeah. Probably for most people, their exposure to poetry begins when they're children, and it's either because poems are read to them or they get into school and teachers feel, well, you know, this is the kind of thing you should be exposed to. Mm-hmm. And they're encouraged to read poetry and they're encouraged to write. And probably for a lot of people, that's where most of their poetry exposure is. And then as they start to get older and older, here and there, people they stay with it. They keep reading it and maybe keep writing it. That they must be, because that's how we get poets. But a lot of people, it falls away from their experience. For yourself, why do you think whenever you started, this was something that you kept doing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I actually started out as an undergraduate as a biology major, and I was really interested in cellular biology. And it's actually what I'm working on in the new collection that I'm working on is poems. It's called A Natural Order, and it's poems about science and mathematics and evolution. So I haven't abandoned that. I just when I was an undergraduate, I started taking these biology classes and these large, you know, chemistry lecture classes, and I was really attracted to science because it had a sense of discovery to it. But when I got in these large classes, I was like, Where's the discovery here? I don't understand. This is all about memorization and tests and, you know, that sort of thing. So when I was a sophomore in college, I took a creative writing course and I jumped ship and started out as a fiction writer. And now I'm a poet. I had a fiction teacher, Elizabeth Cox, who was smart enough to recognize in the prose that I was writing the certain attention to language and description. And she said, you know, maybe you'd find a poetry course a little more suitable to your style. And, you know, history has been made.
Yeah.
But that initial engagement, I think, you know, for me, poetry is a lifeline. It's part of my life, and it's something that I can only get deeper and deeper into. So I don't know if it's something that's intrinsic. I just have a real love for language, the careful use of language, and its musicality, I think it moves me in no other way.
Yeah. I'm sure that for all writers, you write things, and it doesn't matter probably what form you work in, you write things, one writes things, you work on them, and you work on them, and at one point you just say, this is not going anywhere. It's mm-hmm. not working, it's not doing what I want, and you take that and you say, okay, I'm done with that, and you go on. For you, if you're working on a poem, how do you know whether it's working or not? And when does that point come? And I'm sure for everyone that point comes and you say, okay, you just take that and you crumple it up and you either literally or metaphorically, you crumple it up and you throw it in the trash and you, mm-hmm. you say, okay, I'm going to go on and do something else. How do you know when something is working?
I think when I keep repeating the language of the poem in my head, when it's still there, when it sticks. I often start a poem by I hear a phrase in my head, a line or two of language that will just keep ringing there. And then I start working from there. And that line may not eventually end up in the poem, but I think that you know, once I get started and on a roll, that there will be a point at which I realize that the poem has fulfilled itself in terms of plot, and then also in terms of music. I'm a very musical writer. Often I'll hear where the poem wants to go as I'm writing, but I won't exactly know in terms of subject matter where I'm going. So I'm not writing necessarily for plot or subject matter, but I'm writing initially for music.
Hmm. Well, this now. We have a question here from someone actually asked their question off the air, and this is very interesting because it connects very much with what you're talking about here. The caller was interested in having you talk a little bit about the purposes of poetry and the purposes of song and how they might be alike or how they might be different.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's song we usually think of – well, poetry and song are bound together by the lyric, right? The poetry is invested in the lyric usually, and then of course we have song lyrics. I think that poetry has a broader purview than song because usually. Not all the time, but usually when we think of song lyrics, they're rhymed regularly. They have a certain cadence, you know, to fit into 4/4 time or, you know, the refrain, the chorus, the bridge, all of that. So you're working – we can actually think of those as formal elements, just as we – in poetry, we would think of the sonnet or the villanelle as these formal elements. So I think that they are tied together through the lyric. But I think that with song that there are different expectations, more formal expectations of that language.
Hmm. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning, Susan Summers Willett. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Your full name is Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett. However, did you get that name?
Well, I am the only daughter of two very forward-thinking feminist parents who lobbied for the ERA in the 70s. So I take my name from – I was given this name by my parents. I didn't make it up myself or take it on myself. I was named after the famous suffragette Susan B. Anthony. And Summers Willett, actually, those are my parents. Names. Hmm. So I was one of the early hyphenators.
Do you think that that feminist themes are important for you in your writing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I guess if I were to say that, you know, if I were to elongate the way that my description of myself as a poet, I would say that I am a Southern feminist performance oriented poet. The themes, mothers and daughters, that's a prominent theme in the book. I do try to, in many of the voices that I was writing in the mythological characters and literary characters, I was purposefully going back, and trying to embody voices of women in myth and history, to sort of revise their story. Audrian Rich has a wonderful essay, called When We Dead Awaken, where she talks about the feminist imperative to revise work, to re-envision the voices of women, and to go back and not only recover those narratives which have been lost, but also to rethink the way that we understand women in literature. And so my part in that, I was sort of applying that in embodying the voices of these different women.
Hmm. We have talked here on and off about the importance of music and musicality, mm-hmm. and you mentioned one poem, and I thought I would ask you to read the one about tips for living in
absolutely
notes for living in NOLA.
Yes,
that's the one about New Orleans.
Nolens, darling.
Oh well, sorry. See, I'm a Yankee
it's
boy.
New Orleans in the. But if you know if you're living in the Ninth Ward, it's Nolens, darling. There are two things that I should say before I read this, just for readers who aren't familiar with New Orleans. One is I make reference to a jazz man and a park named after that jazz man. That's Louis Armstrong, who is, of course, famous for his song Mack the Knife. And then I also mentioned two Mardi Gras parades, Zulu and Rex. Zulu is a traditionally black parade. Rex is a traditionally white parade, and they follow each other on Mardi Gras morning. Finally, I'll say that I wrote this poem before Hurricane Katrina, but since then, it's taken on special significance. Notes for Living in NOLA. Learn to hate the tourists who booze up, who cruise the one ways the wrong way and ask for the Café du Monde, the Jacks, the Cat's Meow, the Preservation Hall. On Bourbon Street, they fall for, I bet you a dollar I can tell where you got those shoes. Sleep till noon, your belly deep and soft. Deal cards and convince others you once shot the moon. Stay above water. Throw parties when there is weather. Vacation during Mardi Gras or do Mardi Gras every other day. Practice the aesthetics of getting out of bed, chasing the cat, the beauty in wavy views of traffic. Note the poetics of a shirt stuck to your back. Baby, you in jazz land, but don't show the blue notes, the thin ropes of hate and self-hate that hold the place together, that cable the soft banks, that sing red cypress, black wire. Here, murder walks slowly, demands you hand over your wallet and things. Don't make no fuss, and perhaps he might pass or ax you out for a beer. Cultivate a dull eye like the black boys on Bourbon who slide and clack for change, who tap-tap parabolas, who tack bottle caps on their Nikes to jump back to where someone said they from. Acclimate to the smell of exhaust and the canal. Pick up the perpetual gifts of beads and cups that wash onto your lawn year-long. Eat the food you are most afraid of. Don't drink the water. Learn to hate the tourists who rip Mammy's face off the sweet, sweet pralines that mark their journey south, who buy posters of the jazz man whose pearly teeth match the whites of his Mack the Knife eyes, but never go into the park named after this man. It is dangerous. Perhaps you will die by that knife. Find people to love who tell you suspicious histories. Wash dishes and know there is no end to roaches. Celebrate obscure holidays and master riding a bicycle with a buzz. And this, daily rain at 4, torn green fans of saw palmetto rapping at the screen, steam moving from your shoes, the slip of a cool bottle in hand, you grip it just before losing it. Wake up early for Zulu. Leave before Rex. Regret has moved to some other country, so dress, make bets, burn, do nothing. Get on a bus named Cemeteries. These cemeteries are beautiful things.
Very, very nice. This is work of our guest this morning, Susan Summers Willett. It's from her collection, Rome, her first published collection. It's published by the Southern Illinois University Press. And questions are certainly welcome again as we continue to talk. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A few weeks back, Andre Kudrescu was here. Has probably one of the most recognizable voices in all of broadcasting,
yes.
At least if people listen to public radio. And he sounds just like himself. And he was here. He was kind of passing through because he gave some of his, he has a big collection of Romanian books that he gave to the library, and he was here. And we talked a little bit about his city and about the fact that he had just published a collection of writing that he had done about New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he says in that book, and we talked a little bit about the fact that not to run down any other city or any other place, but he says it's difficult for people from other cities to understand the way that New Orleanians feel about their city.
We're and very this, loyal.
This poem, again, you know, makes me think about that, about its character and about how, and I'm sure that happens with other places, that they stamp themselves on the people who live there. But there seems to be something about this particular place.
It's true. You know, and I wasn't even born in New Orleans. I was born in Ohio, and my family, we moved to New Orleans, I guess when I was about 8 or 9 or so. But it's definitely the place that I call my home, that, you know, it's been formative to me in so many different ways. And it's, you know, New Orleans wants you. It just embraces you. And it takes a little while to get used to if you're not originally from there. But it's traditions, its sense of home. It's really just a powerful, powerful place that has plenty of problems. I sort of describe New Orleans as a place which has really high highs and really low lows. And, you know, you sort of oscillate between those two things. Hurricane Katrina was interesting. I visited New Orleans during Mardi Gras this year to try and throw some tourist dollars down there while I was there and help in the rebuilding effort. And I have to say that Mardi Gras was – I know that there seemed to be some sort of debate in the media about whether or not that one should celebrate Mardi Gras after such a horrible tragedy. And, you know, all of the people that I know in New Orleans and myself included say – you know, of course you have to have Mardi Gras. I think it was exactly what the city needed. And there was a real sense of community there this year, which is, you know, it's Mardi Gras is different because this year than others, because it marked the return home for so many people. You know, people were coming back from being displaced and moving back to New Orleans. And this Mardi Gras was really a celebration of that.
Yeah. That's one of the things that he said, that he thought that it was really important to do it, because it was a way for people there to say, we're still here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, at the same time, and as someone now who has lived there and has some connection, but now has been away for a while, I also get the sense that for some people, and we even heard from some of them, I think, probably from time to time as we discussed various aspects of this, had it up to here with Katrina and hearing about it and hear what happened to the people. And do you think that somehow that it's a story that has been overplayed or in some way, to the point where people who don't live there, have no connection to the city at all, would be experiencing this kind of Katrina fatigue?
Well, I can understand how they would be. I mean, it was all over the media for so long. But for somebody who's, you know, from that area, I don't think that it's been an overexposed story at all. I mean, the efforts that it's going to take to rebuild the city and to repopulate the city is going to be astronomical, and it's going to take several years. I mean, New Orleans will be fundamentally changed and has been fundamentally changed by this event, you know, because different folks are going to move back and different businesses are going to open or fail as a result. So there's going to be – New Orleans will be changed, but I think that its original spirit will still remain.
Yeah. Questions are certainly welcome here this morning as we continue to talk with our guest, Susan Summers Ouellette. And if you want to give us a – am I saying that name right?
Ouellette.
Well, you know, I was just now sitting here thinking, okay, Dave, we're going to come up, we're going to say this name again. And I'm thinking, I'm sure I've said it different every single time. And you can find her – go out to the bookstore and find her collection of poetry, Rome. In fact, she will be giving also a reading. This is part of the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series. This is an event of the English Department at the MFA Creative Writing Program. This will be tomorrow at 4:30 in the afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. So questions and comments here are welcome. If you want to stop by there and see her and meet her, you can do that as well. She teaches college courses here in creative writing, contemporary poetry, and poetics, and right now is Andrew W. Mellon, postdoctoral fellow in the humanities here at University of Illinois. You have some poems here in the book about Joan of Arc.
Mm.
What interests you about Joan of Arc?
Well, I have a series of five poems that close the book that are written in the voice of Joan of Arc. Those poems are part of that original project that I was telling you about, you know, taking on the voices of women in myth and history and sort of doing a feminist revision of that, of those voices or how their stories are represented. So that's sort of how it started. I was intrigued by her voice, and I was so drawn to her voice because I read a translation of her heresy trial. It's a book called Joan of Arc in Her Own Words. And the book is a translation of her testimony during her heresy trial. So it was, you know, this interesting original material. And I actually incorporated some of that translated work into the five poems that close the book. So I'm sort of playing with the boundaries of created and received text. Joan of Arc, the poems that close the book, it sort of starts with Joan of Arc's being on trial. She's speaking in response to her inquisitors, and then she sort of goes back and remembers her journey and fighting for the king of France and fighting against these folks. And in the end, I realized that her search was sort of a search for her father God, which of course ties in with the sort of sense of loss that I'm having of my own father at the time. So our voices, I think, mirror each other in that way.
Hmm. Would you like to read one of those?
Yeah, I'll read the final poem in the book where she is being, it's the title is of the poem is Jean in the Presence of Instruments, and this is Jean speaking in her, Joan of Arc speaking in her final moments. The rack, the screw, the hook with pointed end and eye, smoldering sticks, cloth and oil, the jag of an old man's tooth, the stake, an arm of rope, the crushing hammer and the claw, the wooden yoke, horses sent in different directions, rocks dashed to the head and some to the sky, recitation of saints most would not remember, skin stripped from the body, public inquisition, the strong man and his pick, fire. These are what little girls are made of. I am threatened with torture in the presence of instruments. I confess, the truth is not the story you've heard of that sorry girl, or the virago, the bad haircut done on the fly. Not the men I supposedly loved, or the women, their delicate organs curling inside. Not the dumb soul rising upward in its pitiful tube. It's this. I expected celebrations in the name of the king, but also in mine. I attest I am a vain girl, that my father wanted to kill me by drowning, that my God lost his temper and I practiced the dark law of a soldier, that a woman spoke to me and said I must deliver this world, and I desired it. I felt my legs and they became possible, my knee bent tensile, wound like the gut, and I declared to my beautiful world haunted, my heart has chanted, I want, I want. I am threatened as if my body weren't already confirmed, earthbound, powder strewn across the happy sky. The tools make no difference. Where I fly is limitless.
I like the idea of a poet being interested in someone who was said to have heard voices. given
yes,
what you talk about.
We poets do also hear voices.
But, yeah. And I was thinking earlier about how you said sometimes poems begin with a line or something that you just, it's like you hear it in your head and you can't get it out, and it just goes and goes. And maybe that's what you think. Oh, I think I have something here, something that I can work with. It is said that Joan heard voices.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about where poems come from. This is one of those things that I think that people think is a mystery, and I'm not sure that for a poet is actually quite so mysterious.
Right. Well, I think it varies from poet to poet. Myself, I'm working from some obvious political affiliations, some regional affiliations. So subjects of poems sort of present themselves in that way. Although my new collection is, I think, are less based in the Southernist and the feminist imperative. The new collection that I'm working on is, as I mentioned, poems about science and evolution and mathematics, and taking these very left-brained topics and speaking about them with a poet's voice. So in terms of subject matter, you know, it's you're a poet. You can take off wherever you want to from. I think that the poems themselves, the craft of the poem, really has to live in your sense of language. And for me, again, that has to do with musicality and lyricality, trying to get that music back into language and paying careful attention to it.
Mm-hmm. The poems, it seems to me, as someone who is not a writer, that they take many different forms. Is there some, how do you think about what sort of structure for what sort of idea or what sort of collection of words you're going to want to use?
That's a great question, because I know that some poets, we would call them new formalists, I guess, write strictly in form. I like to play back and forth between form, sonnets, villanelles, pantoums, and free verse. There are also poets who write exclusively in free verse too, which I think is, you know, poets who work exclusively in one type of poetry or another, I think, really do themselves a disservice. Not to say that they don't create fantastic work in their various forms, but I really see myself as a poet who eschews boundaries, and I like to work in many different forms, in very formal work, and then free verse, in page poetry and stage poetry. What I try to do is honor the poem itself, see where the poem wants to go, and instead of trying to impose my own goals on the poem.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, as you're working with people who either are poets or want to be poets or think that they could be poets, then is what essentially what you're doing as a teacher, giving them a toolkit and showing them some basic kinds of structures, and then saying, okay, go to it.
Someone recently asked me the question, how can you teach creative writing? And my response is very carefully. I think that that all you can do as a teacher of creative writing is make your students read a lot, because it's through reading that I think we discover our own voices, and then give them a set of tools. As poets and writers, we're crafts people, so you need to get those tools in your tool belt, and then you can use them to create whatever, you know, what if you have different types of tools, you can create sculpture, you can create writing, you can create music. I think that as a teacher, that's exactly what we need to do, is to emphasize the tools and then see where the student goes with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when I think of editing, I think that the business of editing is to try to help that person say what they're trying to say in the clearest way possible. Mm-hmm. So it's when you look at something, I mean, the kind of editing that I might have done or that we do around here with each other, you look at somebody who's written and see, well, this year, this is very confusing. Mm-hmm. Or this year, you know, I really don't think you need that. Mm-hmm. Or this part here, you know, I think it should be up higher in the story because that's a very important idea. Mm-hmm. So the idea is economy, particularly in, or for example, if you're thinking about news and broadcast news, is economy, clarity, you know, the idea that someone's going to be hearing this, they can't go back and hear it again, mm-hmm. they better get it the first time. Mm-hmm. But mostly it's that. I mean, it's trying to say, what is it you're trying to say? Mm-hmm. And what's the best, clearest, most direct way that you can say it? Is that what you're doing too?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that that really marks the difference between, say, journalistic writing, journalistic prose, and creative writing. In creative writing, well, of course, some poems you do want to use, you do want to have an economy of language within the poem, because you want to emphasize careful attention to the language. It's not prose. I was reading something recently. I don't remember who said this, but I thought it was a really good definition of poetry, and that is poetry is that which is unparaphrasable. It has to be said in that way, in that manner, using those exact words. So I think that in some instances you want to go for economy of language. But say, for example, a poet like Walt Whitman, he's all about, you know, splaying his work on the page, and he's not interested at all in the economy of language, but its abundance. And so I think that, you know, when we're as teachers and as writers, when we're talking about creative writing, that we need to take each poem as its own and look at how the language is working within the world of the poem. So I think it's kind of hard to apply a rule like you have to be, you know, economic with your language in a poem. I mean, certainly in a lot of undergraduate workshops, we try to do that, but I don't think as a rule that we can apply it overall to poetry.
We're coming down here about 5 minutes, maybe a little bit less. Would you like to read one more?
Absolutely. I would like to read a new poem, if I may.
Oh, sure.
This is from the collection that I'm working on, A Natural Order. And this poem figures Leonardo da Vinci working on one of his famous anatomical sketches, which he often worked from. He worked from cadavers working on these anatomical sketches, which he often got these from insane asylums and prisons. So that figures a little bit into the poem. Also, there's reference to his apprentice. It's been wondered recently whether or not he had a homosexual relationship with his apprentice. It's called The Golden Lesson. Leonardo cracks the thief's sternum with precision and opens the proportion. Fearful symmetry glistening in the flat, wet lungs like a bird's folded wings or two lozenges of yellow amber laid on a plate. He licks his fingertips blackened by thin strips of coal as the cat suddenly and impolitely asks for its dinner. A body does not do as it is told. He is called Giacomo in, but the boy is rudely eating a wedge of pink melon in the kitchen, sucking at it, in fact, so that his hands will stick with the fruit all night and the pages of his books will bear stains and his boyish odor. The gray shade of evening falls over corpse and artist, as a candle flickers against the body's dark ruin, the neck corded with hard tendon to tether the shoulder's weight of brain and skull, and through it all the windpipe ridged with cartilage climbing up like a soft ladder into the palate. The boy and his 17 years know nothing of this. The life dissected and sectioned out into a dark oval, which is the head, which leans back as if on a string tied to the throat, so that the throat opens into a white-stringed harp centering the imaginary line between halves of the body, the sketch nearly ready, but for the one criminal eye looking up to the artist from the table, removed from the patient with such desire like seeking a stray precious marble. Leonardo calls the boy Salai, which means demon. He pulls back the curtain to reprimand the malingering boy who now has anise candy on his breath, and although he knows Salai has stolen to have it, He does not comment because the licorice seed sweetens the room. The thief's hands cripple on the wood table, and the boy wonders what pleasure was held in this criminal wrist. Perhaps a thirst made its way into the body to play these strings, and the tongue and hand answered. Salai skims the corpse's dull skin with his finger, the body pinned down by the puckering O of the navel, his hand almost free of use dimension. The criminal eye does nothing but hold vigil in its rind of boiled egg white like a blue jewel encrusting a pale woman's ear. Perhaps the eye will study the artist as he draws the body. Perhaps inside the eye, an inverted picture of the two scholars will glint as they point and argue about man's divine proportion, and in their conversation will rise a sound from the thief like a harsh note forbidden in the box of a guitar. The imperfect soul made art from the orphic instrument of muscle and calcium set ringing. Yes, in this room with the blackening window and the organ's sweet odor hotly releasing, the criminal will speak the feckless boy and his teacher like a dark chorus, and the indivisible golden cord will fly up. And who will hear this joy of the body? Who will play the harp in the boy?
Very nice. You enjoy that?
Yes.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Susan Summers-Willen. She teaches here at University of Illinois creative writing, poetry, poetics, and she will be giving a reading. This is part of the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus. So if you're interested in stopping by and hearing more from her and meeting her, perhaps, you can do that. Her first collection of poetry, Rome, has been published by just this month, I think, or last month, by the Southern Illinois University Press. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.
I appreciate it.